Thank you for inviting me. And I already had some very good discussions with people here yesterday. And it's always a pleasure to be here. Next, I have to apologize because my talk is in PowerPoint, especially to Slava, who was vituperating against PowerPoint last night. And I have to admit, it's just completely laziness because I had to prepare it for a talk I gave last week, and so I thought the easy thing is just to use it again. But I apologize for that, and if you want to stop me and interrupt and try to clarify things, please go ahead and do that. So I'm going to, the main topic of the talk will be this, the second idea, which is a way of understanding the Big Bang singularity using ideas of holography, namely ABS-CFT, and I think it's the most concrete model anyone has come up with so far for really describing the passage of a universe through a singularity. I was going to start off by just describing why we're interested in an alternative to inflation. And then I will discuss scale invariant curvature perturbations, probably the most striking result that has emerged from observation, well, apart from the existence of dark energy, which is very striking, but from the observations of the cosmos, one of the fundamental facts is that the early universe somehow generated approximately scale invariant curvature perturbations, and that's what we see, and that's a sort of fundamental thing for theory to try to understand. So I'm going to try and discuss that in a slightly more general way than is normally done, focusing on the symmetry, i.e. the scale invariance, and that will lead naturally into this discussion of ABS-CFT. And the theme of the talk will actually be scale invariance. Scale invariance, that's our hypothesis, is that the reason the universe has scale invariant fluctuations is that the dynamics governing the universe is fundamentally scale invariant. Okay, it doesn't sound so radical, but you see, it will be pretty radical. This is work with following people. John Luplanus is a postdoc at Cambridge, will be at Princeton next year. Paul McFadden is at Amsterdam in Belinda's group, and Paul Steinhardt at Princeton. And the second, the ADS-CFT work is with Ben Krebs, who's in Brussels, and Thomas Hertog, who's in Paris. So far, observations are consistent with spatially flat universe and the simplest possible perturbations, which I call glassy perturbations, for shorthand. They're Gaussian, linear, growing mode, adiabatic. Adiabatic means the composition of the universe does not change from place to place, just the overall density, if you like, or the alternatively, the spatial curvature of constant density hypersurfaces. So the composition doesn't fluctuate. Scalar, meaning that the velocity of the perturbations is the gradient of a scalar, for example. You can completely describe them with a scalar function. And they are scale invariant, which is the main focus of this talk. So these are very simple phenomenological properties which the universe has. And whenever you see a detailed curve of the CMB with wiggles up and down and so on, that is all that it is describing. Okay? This set of properties are sufficient to explain all the observations. These properties, the glass properties, are just as predicted by simple inflationary models, okay? But that doesn't mean that those models are correct. And there are various reasons to question those models. So this picture shows one of the reasons you might be worried about those models, which is that in inflation, one invokes an extra field which drives the exponential expansion of the universe, and you hypothesize that that field was displaced just after the beginning of the universe, just after the singularity. And then this field roll down the hill. So some physical effect started the universal up the hill, and so far there is no explanation of that. It's just a postulate. So it assumes a star in a super dense state. You have to have a huge energy density, and you also have to have that the pressure is approximately minus the energy density in that initial state. This is to say it's potential dominated. You cannot have the kinetic energy or gradient energy in the field driving inflation dominate. You have to have the potential energy dominate. Nobody knows why this should be. The cosmic singularity is not resolved. People just assume the universe somehow inflation started a small time after the singularity. That's not described. So that's unsatisfactory. Inflation requires finely tuned potentials, the self-coupling of the scalar field, if it's lambda phi to the fourth. The lambda has to be tuned to some number less than 10 to the minus 10 in order to get the fluctuations to be small enough. And the dark energy today, which is the energy of the vacuum, represented here by this small gap, has to be tuned to be about 10 to the minus 100 the energy density during inflation. Okay, so every inflation model has this tiny number in it, 10 to the minus 100. And finally, there's this very strange future of these models that you roll down the hill and you get you end at positive dark energy. The dark energy dominates, inflates the universe to the future, and wipes everything out, wipes out the density. And so we have this very strange, empty future. That's, of course, just a strange thing. It may be perfectly correct, but it's a strange thing. So related to this initial problem of having to just displace the field by hand is the question of the measure. How probable is inflation? Okay, and nobody has ever done a fully satisfactory calculation of this. And you can quite easily come up with measures to try to use to address this problem. In particular, a few months ago, we wrote a paper about using the canonical measure on phase space, the dp/dq measure, which has the virtue that it is independent under changes of coordinates on phase space and independent of time. So you can time slice the system at different times, and the measure won't change. And if you use this measure with random initial conditions on phase space, and you have to put in a certain technical assumption, which I won't go into, which essentially amounts to putting in a certain cutoff on phase space. But if you put that in, you get a probability of n e-folds of inflation of e to the minus 3n. So if n is 60, you need 60 e-folds of inflation, the probability is e to the minus 180. So I would argue this measure, it's not fully satisfactory by any means, but I would argue it's better than any other measure anyone else has proposed. And according to this measure, the other measures people propose are not independent of time slicing or coordinates. They're completely ad hoc.
Is the curl of ultraviolet
curl? No, infrared. Our cutoff is to say that we cannot observationally tell the difference between a universe with an omega minus 1 less than some small value. Okay, so if you say all universes with omega minus 1 less than epsilon should be identified because we can't observe any difference. Okay, then you get this answer. And the answer is extremely weakly dependent on epsilon. This is the answer you get in the limit epsilon goes to 0. So I think it's a reasonably robust answer, but it's really addressed at the reason we do it at late times is it's really addressed at people who claim that anthropic arguments would lead you to insist on a certain number of e-foldings in the beginning of the universe. I mean, I think our paper shows that's definitely not true.
But maybe you know that the most popular picture is the picture of eternal unions. I mean, you cannot even speak about the beginning of the universe.
That's a picture, it's not a theory.
Yeah, but you see that already late, you see it will be
Okay. Inflation's most specific signature, tensor modes, have not been seen. And so I think it's premature to decide that inflation happened, and it's very important to keep open to alternative possibilities. So let me just list some of the other motivations, some related to the previous slide, some of the motivations for considering a very radical alternative. Right? Inflation is basically a patch which was added at the beginning of the standard Big Bang model. Okay? The standard Big Bang said you had the singularity 14 billion years ago. The puzzle was that generically you would get a very inhomogeneous universe, so inflation was added, in Mike Turner's words, was added as duct tape. Okay, you just added this thing at the beginning to make the universe very smooth. One puzzle is the dark energy puzzle. Dark energy doesn't seem to play any role in inflation or with the initial conditions for inflation or anything like that. It just comes along right at the end of the story. That's a little weird. It means the model is sort of disconnected. The idea that today's universe is in a dynamical state, I think, is very appealing, especially if you do believe in string theory or supergravity or something. The generic vacua there are, the only stable vacua are negative energy, anti de Sitter, and we're clearly not there. So we have to be in some kind of stable dynamical state. This is such an obvious point, it's amazing you have to make it. But the whole purpose of string and M theory is surely to deal with the Big Bang singularity. I mean, that's the fundamental question in cosmology. And yet, people are shy away from that problem. And since everything we see traces right back to the singularity, I mean, when we look at the universe, we're looking right back at the singularity. Everything we see came out of the singularity. I simply cannot believe that we could ever make a theory of how the state the universe in is selected without understanding the singularity. It doesn't make any sense. So everything came out of the singularity. We obviously have to understand the singularity. And then there's an extremely simple point. Either time began at the singularity or it didn't. Okay? And those are two interesting possibilities to consider. And so far, everyone has been assuming the first, or almost everyone. Has assumed the first, for unfounded reasons, completely unfounded reasons. I mean, the arguments that time began at the singularity amount to saying GR breaks down there, okay, therefore space-time begins there. And that doesn't follow at all. Just because GR breaks down means you need a better theory before you can even address the question.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
It seems that you're carefully avoiding any reference to the no-boundary part-forming.
I love the no-boundary proposal. I love the no-boundary proposal. The no-boundary proposal precisely addresses that. It does address this, it just gives exactly the wrong answer. The no-boundary proposal gives an answer for the probability of the universe, which is essentially e to the entropy of the Sitter space. Okay? And this guy down here has an entropy of 10 to the 120. Whereas this guy up here has an entropy of 1. And so the no-boundary proposal favors the vacuous state by a factor of e to the 10 to the 120. And that's pretty sad for the no-boundary. Now, I know you've got a new way of doing it, which I don't understand. But Hawking's way of doing it gives exactly the wrong answer. It's very sad.
So it's only entropy consideration that rule out in your opinion?
Well, only is the whole thing. It's just saying the Euclidean path integral gives the probability, and it gives e to the minus 10 to 120 probability. So that's pretty bad.
And I see there's one more.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, okay, so at a very simple level, it's a nice answer, because the Euclidean approach says, so what's the probability to get something out of nothing? That's what it's doing. So let's start with nothing, i.e. compact manifold closes, we get nothing. What do you get out of that? The answer is you get nothing out of nothing. You get an empty universe out of nothing.
No, you get everything and get something.
It doesn't work. Well, as currently understood, it doesn't work. If it did work, it would be great. So this is an advertisement. We have a book coming out in a few weeks about cyclic universe. This is Paul Steinhardt and myself, and this is a picture from the book. And it describes how, it describes the scenario that you have these two brains, boundary brains, in M-theory, and they attract one another, generate perturbations, collide, make radiation, and that's how the Big Bang happened. And then dark energy takes over, flattens them out, and prepares them for the next collision. So that was one attempt to make a scenario different from inflation in which the dark energy plays a central role. The dark energy smooths out the universe to some extent. The decay of the dark energy creates the next Big Bang and creates the scale invariant density perturbations. And in that way, one solves the horizon problem, the flatness problem, perturbation problem, and so on in a very different way than inflation. Now, so most of this talk is going to focus on these perturbations, scale invariant perturbations. And I want to explain how the perturbations work in this ekbaronic model. Okay, just in very basic, in terms which highlight the symmetry, the role of symmetry.
Just before you go on, you have a minus sign there. Most people would say this means it's a stable anyway. So.
That's exactly what I said. Most of the only stable states in M theory have negative potential energy.
So this doesn't bother you.
So we can't live there. Okay. However, the reason those states are stable is because one imposes very special boundary conditions on empty de Sitter space. You see, if you have a negative cosmological constant, you know this as a cosmologist, a negative cosmological constant, and you make a small perturbation of the field, the universe will collapse to singularity, and the field will jump out of the singularity.
So the question is, why would we be in the linear?
It's unstable when you... What?
So why do we need the linear regime at all in the first place?
We can get to that later. But the idea of ekbaronic model is that indeed this is a kind of special ground state, which is stable if you impose supersymmetry. But as soon as you relax supersymmetry, actually the theory does this, oscillates up and down here forever. So without the special requirement of supersymmetry, as the universe collapses, any small deviation from here will grow, and the thing will jump out of the potential. So it's a it's a sort of funny dynamical ground state, if you want to phrase it that way. So here's the potential, and let me explain how we get scale invariant. So imagine there's some potential which is exponentially small when the brains are far apart. So phi is the radian, measures how far the brains are apart, and negative, and it will turn out that this constant C has to be large. In Planck units, the C has to be about 10, which is to say it's an inverse mass scale, and the mass scale has to be smaller than the Planck mass. But this model, let's just take it without gravity, and ask what would happen if I have a scalar field with a potential like this, and I let the scalar field fall off the hill. And the answer is you get scalar invariant fluctuations. Okay? And the reason for that is that this theory has a scale symmetry. Okay? I can rescale space-time coordinates by e to the lambda. Now, kinetic terms will scale like e to the 2 lambda when I do that in four dimensions, d4x grad phi squared. So I get e to the 2 lambda, so it's a... It's scale covariant, this theory. And to make the potential scale the same way, I have to shift this scalar field so that the potential scales like e to the 2 lambda. So there's this scale symmetry, shift the rescale space-time coordinates, shift the field. You have to rescale h bar to leave it invariant. That means it's only a classical symmetry. Quantum effects will violate it. And the theory's invariant under this operation. That means that if the field falls off the hill, firstly, the background solution, if there's no initial scale in the background solution, i.e. if I start at zero energy, okay, let's say I start at zero energy, which is, in fact, what the dark energy phase would lead you to. You effectively start at zero energy, you fall off the hill, the scaling solution to the field equations with no work, you can see the only possibility is that phi dot goes like 1 over t, because this phi dot will not change due to the shift, just a constant shift. The d by dt will change because of that factor, and so therefore the answer has to be 1 over t. So the scaling solution is that phi dot goes like 1 over t. That's the background. The second thing you have to do is, when you're analyzing the fluctuations on long wavelengths, just ask yourself, what is the growing mode in these fluctuations? And in this case, the growing mode is very simple, that the theory has a time translation symmetry. And so if I have a background solution phi dot, then there is a perturbation, delta phi, which is phi dot. So I just take the background phi as at t plus epsilon at another time, and the perturbation is phi dot. That goes like 1 over t. So we've identified the growing mode perturbation as 1 over t.
But it's not
fictitious. It's fictitious mode.
There's no gravity in the game yet. Okay, so we'll get to gravity later. I'm just doing this. I'm doing this in Minkowski space. This is a perfectly legitimate mode. You do it at non-zero k, small but non-zero k.
Is it consistent?
I can write down the exact solution if you want to see it.
No, it's completely not there. I want to ask you. These arguments are okay. Yes. No, it's not to understand. I know that this vector, which is generated, depends on C in the potential, because there is deviation from scaling invariance. You see? And here in your argument, I do not see these deviations, and also you see it looks like it works for NEC.
It does work for NEC.
No, but
if you ignore gravity. Okay, without gravity. I'm going to get to gravity
later.
Without
gravity, there is no perturbation.
No, we're considering a field in Minkowski space, falling off a hill in Minkowski space. I want to know what are the correlations of that field with itself in Minkowski space.
But the quantum of gravity says no scale of curvatures, you understand.
I'm not talking about the curvature.
Usually refers to the scales which are like on the scale.
You're jumping ahead. I'm talking about the spectrum, the correlation of the scalar field. Don't bring cosmological curvature perturbations into it. This is just the scalar field spectrum as it falls off a hill.
This should be decay.
This is just do as an exercise, compute the equation for the fluctuation. It looks like this. Are you familiar with this equation? I mean, if I just calculate this equation, box delta phi equals v minus v comma phi phi delta phi. You agree that's the right equation for the fluctuation? Okay?
The background is this flat here, yeah?
In the flat space-time. So it's all in flat space-time. Okay? So the curvature, the potential has a negative curvature. That's what drives the, that's what produces this term. And then you'll recognize this term. What is this equation? It's equation for a scalar field in visitor space. Exactly what you'd use in inflation. Okay?
No, it's not exactly.
Yes, it is.
Okay, if you exactly use it, whatever you move it to the
Okay, so, keep interrupting, but I can explain this in more detail later. Suffice it to say that this scale invariant, these arguments are correct, okay? The scaling solution is this, that there is a time delay mode. It grows like 1 over t, and now I can just read off the spectrum, the fluctuations. Because I know that the spectrum has to be scalar invariant, has to respect the symmetry. Now, delta phi doesn't transform because it's a difference between phi and the background, so that does not transform. So this left-hand side is scalar invariant under this symmetry. H-bar scales like e to the 2 lambda. T, I know it must go like t to the minus 2 because I square this time dependence. And then the point is that this is invariant. This combination is invariant of the scale symmetry. And so I have to write down some integral over k, but whatever it is, it has to be scalar invariant. So the only answer you can possibly get is this one. And that's why you get scalar invariant perturbations. So this symmetry leads to scalar invariant fluctuations. Now let me just redo De Sitter space in the same language, inflation, and show you that indeed there's a scale symmetry, and that's why you get scalar invariant perturbations. So De Sitter space, one could write in conformal coordinates. That makes sense, because we want to deal with t and x in the same way. So we write it as conformally flat. This is the metric in conformally flat coordinates. The symmetry is just a rescaling of t and a rescaling of x. And obviously, the metric doesn't change at all if you do that. Okay. Now, the next thing is we have to identify the growing mode in the scalar field. That's what I did up here. I want to know the time dependence of delta phi. And this is trivial in this case because a massless field in De Sitter has a shift symmetry. Phi goes to phi plus constant. So the time dependence of the perturbations on long wavelengths is trivial. Delta phi is constant. So delta phi squared cannot have any t dependence because it's constant. It has to be invariant under this scaling. Doesn't involve t at all. The only scale invariant thing you can write down is this. And then you know that it must be proportional to the h bar. And if you stick this into the action, you'll see the h bar comes with h squared. This comes from the root minus g, g mu nu. There'll be two powers of the conformal factor. So that's the answer. Okay, so scale invariance is a consequence of scale invariance in both theories. But I'm going to show you a much deeper scale invariance, which will give the same answer. Okay, in the next part.
Have you seen Neil? Say one sentence. As I told you yesterday, inflation never predicts scale invariance.
Not exact scale invariance.
Not scale invariance at all. It's the same
thing
as you would play, for instance, at QCD.
But look, Slava, no, this is totally obvious from this formula.
Yeah.
Inflation is not the De Sitter space. Inflation is a De Sitter space which is slowly decreasing in Hubble constant.
No,
that's all there is.
The sequence that you would get infinite perturbation, as you know very well. And this kind of consideration, in spite of the fact that they would probably have nothing to do with the LCA, Yeah.
All I'm doing here is a massless scaling De Sitter. I'm not including gravitation.
Yeah, massless scalar field in De Sitter has not much to do with the generating.
No, nonsense. So it's exactly this mechanism that generates scale invariance. You don't think the massless scalar fluctuations are the heart of the inflationary mechanism?
And plus, there is instability there. As you know, which actually spoils the invariance of the De Sitter space.
That's fine.
Because in De Sitter space, you would never have graceful exercises.
That's right. That's just saying that H is not a constant.
Yeah, but if two things actually look just similar, it doesn't mean that they are the same.
Okay. Now include gravity. I wasn't including gravity before. Let's include it. And it becomes, the issue becomes more more subtle with gravity for some of the reasons Slava is saying. Because obviously, a time delay in gravity can be thought of as a gauge transformation. Okay? Whereas in Minkowski space, it can't. In gravity, it can be thought of as a gauge transformation. So you have to be more careful. When you're doing gravity, that this time delay mode is actually a genuine physical mode. When you include gravity, there is an easy way of identifying the two long wavelength growing modes, or growing or decaying modes, the two adiabatic modes in gravity. So let's write our metric in a Newtonian gauge. And one easy way to see where these modes come from is to do a small coordinate transformation. Okay, so at first you might think this is unphysical because it's just a coordinate transformation. But actually, if you do a coordinate transformation and then you throw away the spatial gradients, then it's not a coordinate transformation anymore. It's a real deformation of the metric. And furthermore, that deformation will solve the field equations to leading order in the gradients because it's nearly a gauge transformation, and the only difference are those gradients. So this is sort of a cheap trick for getting the two modes. So here they are. So these coordinate transformations leave this metric in Newtonian gauge form when I throw away spatial gradients. There are two modes, a dot over a squared. This is a time delay mode. And this mode is a local dilation of space. Okay, so these are essentially the two adiabatic cosmological modes. In an expanding universe, this time delay mode is generally decaying. Okay, that's why we usually ignore it. the time delay mode since the Big Bang is decaying. In fact, it's perfectly gauge invariant in the sense that Newtonian potential, there is a solution of the equations in a fixed gauge, which goes like a dot over a squared, but it's decaying, so we usually ignore it. Whereas the dilatation mode is growing, or at least constant in an expanding universe. Okay, you get this alpha 2 x times 1. And that's the usual mode we concentrate on. In a contracting universe, it's just the time reverse. So this mode is now would be considered the decaying one, and this mode would be considered the growing. So the role of these two modes reverses in between a contracting and an expanding universe. So one argument against the idea that you could generate realistic perturbations in a pre-Big Bang phase, in a contracting phase, okay? The argument is, if you generated them, surely they will be in this mode. They'll be in the time delay mode, because that's what grows in a contracting universe. But what you want is them to be in the dilation mode. Okay, it's just the wrong mode. So it's generating scale invariant perturbations, but in the wrong mode. And so many people have raised this point in various ways. It was most clearly made by Criminelli et al. How can a time delay match onto a spatial dilation? One answer which we've put forward is that there are actually 5D effects near the bounds. It's not really described by 4D effective theory. 4D effective theory breaks down near the bounds. There are 5D effects which can actually connect these two modes. That's a very complicated story and actually very difficult to solve the equations fully. So I think that's not, it's not fully resolved whether you can actually do this. Recently, we made another proposal, and then there's been a whole flurry of papers this year about this, which is a mechanism for creating the right mode in a contracting universe using additional light degrees of freedom in the 4D effective theory. So the second mechanism is entirely phrased within 4D effective theory and works just fine. So the idea behind the mechanism is extremely simple. Instead of having one scalar field, have two, okay? And they're both falling off a hill. And then and they're independent. These two independent fields, both falling off the hill. Then compute their relative perturbation. And in fact, we compute delta phi over phi dot. This is, in fact, the time delay in the phi 1 solution, subtract the time delay in the phi 2 solution. That is a local gauge invariant quantity. Okay, that's perfectly measurable at every point in space. You just ask, what's the difference between these two fields, and what's the relative delay between them? So that's a gauge invariant quantity. It's definitely scale invariant on long wavelengths if they both have fallen off the hill. But then this quantity, because it's local in space, it converts very easily to the scalar curvature. Okay, so the general result is that the scalar curvature of space, this is the curvature perturbation which Slava was talking about, the change of the curvature perturbation is sourced by the entropy perturbation, and I've written it this way just in case you have lots of scalar fields around. So what you do to get the entropy perturbation is take the perturbation and then subtract off the component of the perturbation which lies along the classical background solution. That's all this is doing. So take delta phi, project off the component along the classical background solution. This is now a gauge invariant quantity which is local and this sources the curvature perturbation if the scalar field trajectory deviates from geodesic motion. So if you have a scalar field following a geodesic, you still get that curvature, but if you can bend the trajectory, then the entropy goes straight into R. So as a specific scenario in which you can do this, let's look at heterodic M theory, which reduces to a five-dimensional model. Here is the effective action in five dimensions. You have two brains, a plus and a minus brain. You have a bulk scalar field, which is the volume of the Calabi-Yau. And you have Einstein gravity in 5D. Then the point is there are two moduli, the radion and this phi. Question is, can we use this mechanism to generate curvature perturbations for both, using both of these fields to get scalar invariant perturbations? So here is the warp factor of the bulk. It's actually linear in this model. So there's a plus and a minus brain. And then the point is that there's some modulus, well, there are two moduli, describing the volume of the Calabi-Yau and the radion. And what happens in the colliding brain solution is this negative tension brain hits the zero of the warp factor just before the collision. And as it bounces, that causes the fields to bounce on moduli space. And that bounce leads to a non-zero, leads to a delta function over here. Literally, the fields hit a brick wall when that thing bounces, and that converts entropy to curvature before the Big Bang.
This is here all the warp factor. It's a boundary of one plane.
Well, the warp factor is, I mean, outside the brains, it's just a virtual space. It doesn't really exist. The brains are the boundaries of space-time. But what this means is that this brain tends to, if it is traveling in this direction, it moves to the point where its scale factor hits zero.
So it's a singularity.
It is a singularity. It's an extremely mild singularity in the following sense. It would correspond to the horizon. But this case, there is no horizon there. It's really a naked singularity in the exterior, in the virtual space-time. And in fact, other people had concluded this singularity was a disaster. But I'll show you it's not a disaster, because this is the picture of this is the full 5D solution. So if you actually solve the 5D equations for these brains moving towards a collision, here's the brain collision. Green is the negative tension brain. Red is the positive tension brain. The solution involves the green guy coming in, grazing this naked singularity. It's actually trajectory is tangential to it. And then it comes in and hits the red guy. So there is a singularity here when the negative guy encounters the zero of the warp factor. But if you put an arbitrarily small amount of matter of any type on that brain, then it never hits the singularity. It bounces. And this is because negative tension brains have the wrong sign of Newton's constant, if you like. They have sort of anti-gravity. So we've shown this in detail in the 5D solution. And if you try to describe this in the 4D effective theory, what happens is you have these two moduli. You have phi 2 and phi 1. And the trajectory you're considering, basically, this phi 2 being positive would correspond to going past the zero. And so when you describe this in the 4D effective theory, there's just a brick wall at phi 2 equals zero, and due to the bounce of this negative tension brain. So as the solution comes along here and bounces, there's a delta function in R dot, and that converts the entropy into curvature. There are other ways to convert it. For example, if this trajectory were not a straight line, in field space, that would also convert it. And other authors have focused on this mechanism.
Sorry, can I ask? So yeah. If you really were to hit that boundary, then from a 4D effective point of view, you get a curvature similarity?
No, you don't. It's just that what happens is that there are couplings in the theory. When you write down the 4D effective theory, there will be couplings. If you put matter, essentially the scale factor on the negative tension brain is going to zero. So it means if I have some matter living on that brain, it will have couplings like this, meaning that their couplings go to zero. And that resists the phi 2 ever going to zero. A term like this will induce a potential for phi 2, which causes it to bounce. So it's more that any matter you put on there would go to infinite density.
But this is a strong coupling limit for phi, if you have the kinetic term is coefficient tending to zero, this would go in the direction of high and low light.
It would. As I said, if you have finite density of this guy, you never hit zero in the background solution. Okay, so of course this all leads unresolved. All we've shown is that you can generate curvature before the Big Bang, scale invariant curvature before the Big Bang. But the real issue is this guy. How do you get through the singularity here? That is the Big Bang singularity. When these two brains collide, they are finite, but one dimension of space has disappeared. Okay, so that's certainly not describable using GR. And one model we made for the back was, this was done with Malcolm Perry and Paul Steinhardt, was to consider a configuration in 11-dimensional M-theory consisting of two colliding boundary brains. And this is Minkowski space, just in other coordinates. So the brain, so the space-time in between the brains is absolutely flat. There's nevertheless a singularity along here. So you can argue this solution is a solution to the M-theory field equations because the Riemann curvature is zero. And so whatever the corrections are, it has to be a solution. But of course, there's a singularity here. And what we pointed out is that the lightest degrees of freedom in this setup consists of winding M2 brains, okay, joining these two boundary planes. These behave like strings near the singularity. And the basic thing we showed is that the classical evolution of these winding states is actually completely regular across t equals zero. Even the space, though the space-time has a singularity, the equation of motion of the winding M2 brains, or equivalently the strings, is actually regular across the singularity. In fact, we were able to calculate the temperature of the hot Big Bang due to string creation in the space-time. But this setup was criticized because of the following fact, that we indeed showed that the winding states, which would be the perturbative states in string theory, had smooth evolution through the singularity. We showed that. But we didn't show, what about the non-perturbative states in string theory? Okay, so these correspond to the non-zero Kaluza-Klein modes of the membrane in electric. And what do they do? Okay, so they may have some disaster. So that motivated us to go to a fully non-perturbative formulation of M-theory, which we would like to use to propagate not just linear perturbations, not just small perturbations through the Big Bang, as the other model does, but black holes. We want to be able to propagate black holes through the Big Bang.
Okay?
Yeah.
So besides winding modes, I guess that's what you mean on perturbative states, there are momentum modes, right? So
that's what I mean.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, the winding modes have...
Winding modes are non-perturbative.
Because from the string theory point of view, they're non-perturbative states.
You can put the momentum in the string, right?
No, the string has no... The string is the dimensionally reduced membrane. That's what a string is.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, there's this beautiful paper by Berman and Perry, which last time I checked had zero citations, okay, which means it's really good. Okay, and this paper shows that winding M2 brains reproduce string perturbation theory, in superstring perturbation theory, and including the coupling to the dilaton, which violates conformal invariance at the classical level. They showed that you get the right.
The momentum modes are singular.
Right, so that's just what you're saying, that if I have some wiggles along here, that's a non-zero momentum mode, and there's no indication in this picture that such things would be regular across the singularity. Okay, so that motivated us to go to a more powerful framework, which...
So it's three-brain, not two-brain, huh?
No, two-brain. In M-theory, there's an M2-brain, fundamental M2-brain. So, sorry.
2+1 surface.
2+1 surface. Yeah. So you have 9 dimensional planes. The bulk is 10 dimensional space. nine-dimensional planes, and then what comes up, then you have these winding N2 braids which go from one plane to the other.
I used to think that your brains are the usual 3 plus 1.
Yeah, we would get our brains, our three-dimensional brains would really be compactified versions of these guys, which are nine-dimensional brains. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have another six dimensions, and you just wrap it in a cloudy house.
But in this Berman theory, it was two brains.
Yeah, they were really looking at 11-dimensional setup with M2 brains. And what happens with the M2 brains is when these planes become very close, the M2 brain is a very thin band, and basically it's a string. It's a fundamental string. So this is showing that you go from 11 dimensions with M2 brains to 10 dimensions with strings. Okay, but it was motivated by this work. Okay, let's now go to ABS-CFT, which is a more powerful framework. And we want to look at a setup where we can examine cosmological singularities, but where we have a chance of describing what happens at those singularities at a non-perturbative level, including all the states. So the hypothesis which is made, and which we will just take as being true, is that there is a bulk theory, which is type 2b supergravity, compactified on S5 plus ADS5. And there's a boundary theory, which is a conformal field theory. And we're going to work in this five-dimensional model for a technical reason, which is that the boundary theory is easy to understand. There's a more realistic version of this, which has a four-dimensional bulk, but the boundary theory doesn't have any small coupling constant, dimensionless coupling constant. And so even though in principle it can be studied perfectly well, it's very hard to do that. So we're going to go through this five-dimensional bulk with a scalar field representing one of the moduli of this compactification. And so our starting point was this paper by Hertog and Horowitz, which in fact drew the conclusion, the opposite conclusion to ours. Okay, they used this model to show you could not get through the singularity, but we'll show that you can. And their point was that if you set up this dual theory, there is a scalar field in this compactification. So basically you have gravity and a scalar and many scalar fields, but there's one scalar field which is tachyonic. Okay, so its potential looks like that. And the ABS vacuum consists of this field being there at the top of the potential. And this scalar field satisfies the Breit-Lohner or saturates the Breit-Lohner-Friedman bound. They showed that the system is stable with certain boundary conditions, okay, even for masses as large and negative as this one.
This is a five-dimensional field, yeah? Five.
Phi lives in five dimensions. It's a bulk field.
The ADS five, yeah?
Exactly. And it has a potential like this. So the point that Hertog and Horowitz and other people made is that the boundary conditions on ADS can be altered without spoiling the correspondence between the bulk and the boundary. And so if you look at the most, you see, in this picture you have a global time. There's a time which is the same in the bulk and the boundary. So you can analyze all the modes just by normal modes with respect to that time. And if you look at a normal mode of frequency omega, then there are two solutions of the fluctuation equation for the scalar field. One goes like 1 over r squared, one goes like 1 over r squared log r. Both are normalizable. Okay, so neither of these diverge at large radius. So a priori, you should keep them both. But if you keep them both, then the dynamics are not defined. You have too many degrees of freedom, and you have this open boundary, and you can't predict anything.
What about r to 0?
No, no, this is at large r. This is at large. These are perfectly regular, asymptotic at large r. Yeah, I should have said that, at large r. It's regular in the interior. Both modes are regular and normalizable. With supersymmetry, that should be an alpha. So supersymmetric boundary conditions throw this guy away and just keep this one, and then there's no dynamics. The system is stable and static, and nothing happens. But if you pick a relationship between alpha and beta, then you get dynamics. Then actually, this field is allowed to fall off the hill. And what happens is that the bulk collapses to a finite time cosmological singularity. This field, if you perturb it, will just fall off the curve. Go to infinity in a finite time, and that's a big crunch singularity. So the picture is that if I adopt these more general boundary conditions, I get interesting cosmology. And from the boundary theory, this corresponds to a deformation of the CFT. With supersymmetric boundary conditions, you just get n equals 4 Yang nils at large n. But with this deformation, there's now an extra operator in that theory. Yeah?
So presumably your alpha is time dependent on zero. So
yes.
So
yes.
Are you making an injecture that alpha and beta are the relations that you have? So
yes.
Time invariant?
Yes.
That's a very strong conjecture, because strictly speaking, in the language of AJCFT, what you're turning on, an operator, a non-normalizable mode of operator.
Right.
And usually the normalizable mode is determined by non-singularity condition. So somehow you pull an
I think you're thinking in Euclidean terms. It's a good point, but I think you're thinking in Euclidean terms.
No, I don't
terms.
Have to. I can think in impossible that it's just a different boundary condition system.
Okay.
But it's always the case.
We are picking, in fact, I'll show you exactly the rationale.
I think it's too strong. So it's what I'm trying to say, it's not a surprise that you get singularity because you put too much constraint. I think what you should.
But wait, it'll be a handleable singularity. We'll get a singularity, but we know what to do with it. I'll show you.
Okay.
Okay. So with this generalized boundary conditions, you get a deformation in the CFT. And the nice thing is this deformation drives the CFT unstable. So indeed, you allow the bulk to go unstable, and the CFT goes unstable at the same time. So the particular deformation we will assume is by imposing this condition that alpha is lambda beta with some coupling lambda. Okay? And this, as you said, should hold at all times. This was proposed by Witten, or it was shown by Witten, that this choice corresponds to deforming the CFT by adding minus lambda phi to the fourth to the potential of the CFT. And the interesting point is that the lambda comes in with the wrong sign. Okay, of course, that makes sense. That bulk is going singular, so the boundary should go singular. And that's the deformation which does the trick. This phi squared, I'm calling it phi. Really, it's a more complicated thing. There are six adjoint scalars, and really this phi is some trace of the difference between these adjoint scalars in the n equals 4 theory. But the CFT also has an instability. Now, a beautiful point, which was not noticed before, actually it was noticed by Witten, but not by Hertog and Horowitz, was that this lambda is asymptotically free. If you consider phi to the fourth theory with negative lambda, then lambda is asymptotically free. So when you...
Yes.
Oh, sorry, no A. Symptotically. Sorry, asymptotically free.
Otherwise, it's so symptotically
free. Asymptotically free. And so you can calculate the effective potential of this theory, and you can calculate by summing. It turns out at large n, there's a subset of diagrams which you can sum completely. Then, roughly speaking, is you have just lambda phi to the fourth, but the lambda runs. It's asymptotically free, so the lambda goes like 1 over log phi over L. Okay. So, and you notice lambda's disappeared in this formula. The coefficient is now exact. What's happened is dimensional transmutation, where the dimensionless coupling is translated into a scale, and the scale, M, is the scale at which the coupling becomes strong. Okay. So, and we will always be working in a regime where phi is much bigger than n, bigger than that scale, so the coupling will always be weak. At large n, the beta function in this theory is one loop exact, and the potential, it actually has contributions beyond this one. This is leading order in the coupling, but the potential under very good perturbative control. All the higher contributions are down by powers of lambda, which is small. So this is really very good situation to be in. You understand the potential, and the fact that the renormalization of the potential does nothing to remove the singularity. All it does is introduce a log. But this phi to the fourth will always overwhelm the log. And this will be our picture, that actually there'll be a bang when this phi hits infinity. Phi will bounce back from infinity, and our cosmology will be in here. And basically, if you can solve the CFT on the boundary, you can, in principle, and I think in practice it's not hard, to translate those boundary fluctuations into the bulk and figure out what's going on in the bulk. So let's look at a bit more at this unstable CFT. It has a potential, which includes the minus lambda phi to the fourth. It also has a conformal coupling, r phi squared, and it lives on a sphere. It's really living on S3, on a sphere which you can take to be of radius, the ADS radius. Okay, so we'll work in those units. The Ricci scalar on the sphere is RADS to the minus 2, and this is the potential. So the scalar potential looks like this. You cannot trust it at small phi, because that's where lambda becomes strong coupling. But at large phi, it's all under control. And we're going to take the scale m to be much smaller than the inverse ADS radius. This will guarantee that if I start my field here at zero energy and rolls off to infinity, I'm always going to be at weak coupling. Weak lambda. Lambda will be much less than 1. So now, there's an important point, which is that the CFT lives on a finite volume. The CFT lives on a 3-sphere of radius equal to the ADS radius. And so when you describe the background solution, okay, it's in a finite space. It's really quantum mechanical. Normally, in field theory, we work in an infinite volume limit, in which the background time-evolving scalar field can be really treated as classical. Here, that's never true. Okay? The scalar field is really quantum mechanical because there's a finite volume of the 3-sphere, so you need to define some wave function for it. And this wave function is going to travel off to infinity in finite time, and then we'll adopt a certain extension of the quantum mechanics called the self-adjoint extension, which causes the wave function to come back to bounce. So the key points, there's no gravity in the CFT, okay? That's obvious. And that's great, because we're trying to resolve singularity, so let's at least throw out the gravitational problem. You don't have to worry about gravity. All we have to do is solve the singularity in the quantum field theory. Okay, then we simply translate our answer back into the bulk. So if we come through the singularity on the boundary, we will just have to translate those results into the bulk, and then we predict what gravity gives. Secondly, there's a finite time singularity. What that means in the quantum field theory is you get ultra-locality. Okay? As you head towards a singularity in this fixed space-time, the dynamics becomes ultra-local. Spatial gradients become unimportant. I'll show you that explicitly in a minute. And that means that every point of space decouples from its neighbors. You get ultra-locality. Every point is distinct. And so you're really describing quantum mechanics. Every spatial point on this 3-sphere has a quantum mechanical system encountering phi equals infinity. And so all we have to do is resolve the singularity within quantum mechanics. But in quantum mechanics, there is a natural resolution of the singularity via the self-adjoint extension, which I'll show you in a second. Asymptotic freedom, I've emphasized already. Yeah.
Let me get back to the first one here. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? Which sense there is no gravity in your particular?
This is just ABS-CFT. ABS-CFT says that a gravitational theory is dual to the non-gravitational theory.
So there is no any notion of metric on the boundary.
It's fixed. It's a fixed. The boundary has a rigid space-time.
Just flat.
No, it's a three-sphere. The boundary is a three-sphere. It's a conformal boundary of ABS.
It's
a three-sphere times time. So that's the ABS-CFT conjecture, which is what we're assuming.
And this self-adjoint expression, boundary conditions in this, what is it,
I'll just show you that in a minute. It's not the fifth. No, we're entirely on the boundary. So just forget the bulk. Okay? What's the statement is that if I can solve the dynamics on the boundary, that will predict the dynamics of the bulk.
There is no boundary or boundary, so what do you mean by the self-adjoint usually deals with boundary conditions?
This is dealing with phi going to infinity. The self-adjoint extension resolves the problem that even the quantum mechanics problem is singular as phi goes to infinity.
Will you show this?
Yes. Okay, so finite volume, it will turn out the entire background becomes quantum around the singularity. Very quantum, okay, but in a way which you can understand. And the main point will be that the CFT is scale invariant, approximately scale invariant, because it has a log running. And that directly translates into scale invariant perturbations. Okay, and we're going to find scale invariant perturbations coming out of our bang because of the scale invariance of the CFT. And I would claim that's a much deeper explanation of its scale invariance. Okay, so let's tell you about ultralocality. I won't go through all of this, but here's the scalar field equation. This term is subdominant near the singularity, so you can forget about the curvature of the three-sphere. Essentially, you just have to solve this equation and see how it goes singular. Okay, so it's a non-linear equation, but it's just a scalar field in flat space-time, and you have to study its singularities. So it turns out you can write down the general solution of this equation, okay, as an expansion around the singularity. So phi is going to go to infinity along some hypersurface in space-time. And so I just expand the solution around that singularity, and I can write down the general solution. The general solution, you define a metric. It's not the real metric. It's a sort of metric because the natural coordinate system is proper time normal to this hypersurface. And you can define an extrinsic curvature of that surface and so on. And then you can show that if I define chi to be 1 over phi is going to infinity, so chi is going to 0, then this is the general solution of that equation, expressed as a power series in tau. Tau is the proper time away from the singularity. Okay? Why do I say it's the general solution? Well, it has two arbitrary functions of space in it. One is t of x, the location of the hypersurface of time. That's one arbitrary function. The second arbitrary function comes in at order tau to the fifth. And I call it rho because what it means is the local energy density in the field phi at that point on the singularity. See, as you fall off a hill, energy is conserved, so you still have a finite energy as you hit the singularity, and that's where it comes in, tau to the fifth. So you can write down this, the general solution as a series expansion, and it's expansion in tau times gradients along the spatial hypersurface. But this is the full nonlinear classical solution. It's only a classical solution. Okay? I'm going to argue next that all you need to define the quantum mechanics and the quantum field theory are classical solutions. The reason for that is if you fall off a hill, as you go to large phi, the WKB approximation becomes exact. Okay? So you know, because the wavelength of the particle, if I fall off this hill, as I go to large phi, the wavelength becomes shorter and shorter, and you can calculate the change in one wavelength over one wavelength, and it goes to zero, so WKB becomes exact. That means that this classical solution can actually be used to calculate the quantum evolution. In fact, the way it works is rather nice. If you look in the linearized theory, so just expand in Ts of x at linear order, assuming the fluctuations are small, the logs, so there were some logs of the solution, the logs only come in at nonlinear order, okay, in Ts. At linear order, in fact, both modes of the field are completely regular at t equals 0. Turns out they obey a singular equation, but nevertheless, so there's a singular equation for the linearized perturbations, but both solutions are regular. The reason for that is that one of them is even in t, and the other is odd in t, and they sort of don't interfere. So this is the linearized theory is regular, t equals 0. One, the Ts is the time delay, and this rho is the perturbation in the Hamiltonian density. And it turns out that what the quantum extension does is it just matches these two properties. You match the time delay and the energy perturbation. Yeah.
So you just throw away. So there will be an even solution which will be non-singular, but the odd solution will be singular.
No, both even and odd are non-singular. Okay, so I had some equation. When you work out the equation, you'll get something like this. I'll probably get this coefficient wrong, but it's something, maybe it's 4. Delta chi dot minus k squared delta chi. Okay? So you look at this equation, and you say it's got a regular singular point at t equals 0. Generally, when you have a regular singular point, so then there are two solutions. If I look at large at small k, or in other words, at small t, this term dominates. So you get delta chi going like going like constant. That's a dot here, or t to the fifth. Okay, those are the two solutions. Now, in general, when you have a regular singular point and your two solutions have integer powers, you will find the first solution has integer powers all the way up. And when its integer power hits the other guy's integer power, then logs appear. That does not happen here, because this one is even, and that one's odd. And so when you solve for this one, you just get t squared, t to the fourth, t to the sixth, right? This you get t to the fifth, t to the seventh, and so on, no logs appear. So it just happens that both solutions are regular, even though the equation is singular.
So the background is singular, but the perturbation around the background is
regular. Yeah, that's funny. I'm not going to argue, there's still a problem with these perturbations. Okay. In fact, I'm going to argue the classical background makes no sense near the singularity. But at the linearized level, it's actually nice. There are no logs. So there's no ambiguity about how to propagate the perturbations across. So this is the point, completely regular. They match unambiguously across t equals 0. And then the nonlinear perturbations are then completely determined, because there's no new data that enters in the nonlinear perturbations. So now let me explain the self-adjoint extension. So imagine I'm just doing quantum mechanics, but in a potential which is unbounded below, and will have a finite time singularity. So this was worked out in the 70s by Reed and Simon. They wrote a whole book about this. And what they pointed out is there is a reasonably natural way of defining the evolution of such a system. Okay? So the potential is unbounded below, and the wave function will travel off to infinity at finite time. If you don't do anything, it'll sail off to infinity and never come back, and it's not unitary.
Just the wave function is the solution of what? Schrödinger equation?
Schrödinger equation.
Yeah,
that's right. So what I'm arguing is the CFT becomes ultra-local, and so I'm just doing quantum mechanics in this potential.
For a homogeneous mode, so it's
for homogeneity, exactly. Okay. So if I do nothing, the wave function is just going to go off to infinity, and then you'll find it's not unitary evolution. You just lose probability at infinity. And so what you do with the self-adjoint extension is very simple. You say you have defined the wrong Hilbert space. You're allowed arbitrarily right-moving wave functions and left moving wave functions. And what you really need to do is divide the Hilbert space by two. So they are not independent right moving and left moving modes. They're only half of those modes. Okay. So what Reed and Simon proposed is the way to define, so WKB becomes exact. That's easy to show. I won't go through it. What they show is that if I consider an energy eigenstate of this system, okay, how am I going to define that? Well, they say when you have a right moving WKB solution, you have to simply add the left moving one with the same amplitude and an arbitrary phase. Okay? So the self-adjoint extension introduces an arbitrary phase, but that's all. There's a parameter between 0 and 2 pi, a dimensionless parameter.
Sorry, when you mentioned self-adjoint extensions, you referred to an extension from operator.
Exactly.
So which operator?
The Hamiltonian. So if I reduce the Hilbert space in this fashion, the Hamiltonian is self-adjoint. And then the evolution is unitary.
So you're saying these two separators are embedded from below, but it's a symmetric operator, and
that's right.
Here exists the U1 family of slightly self-adjoint.
Yeah, there's a way of reducing the system to make the Hamiltonian self-adjoint.
So if the amplitude of that position is not 1,
right,
then it is not self-adjoint.
Exactly.
Just the simple naive sense.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's obvious because you're losing probability. Everything goes to the right should come back. Exactly. Okay, so now something that will be very important in what follows is that when I work out this wave function, as I argue, WKB becomes exact at large phi, and we're mostly interested in large phi. So in large phi, P phi, the momentum just goes like this, which goes like phi squared. So in this integral, you'll have e to the I integral d phi phi squared. In WKB, this is the normalization factor. And p phi goes like phi squared. That tells you the wave function goes like 1 over phi at large phi. So the wave function is coming out here, getting these large oscillations, but its amplitude is dying like 1 over phi. Okay? And that's what makes the wave function normalizable. So there's no problem with doing ordinary quantum mechanics because the wave function is normalizable. But that's going to be important in a second. So let's now, it's interesting to ask what happens if I start with this wave function, say in a Gaussian at the initial time, okay? Naively, you might say this Gaussian wave packets will sail off to infinity, okay, encounter the singularity, and then with the self-adjoint extension will come back. And it's a little bit more complicated. Basically, that is the correct picture, but it's a little bit more complicated because it turns out this Gaussian wave packet develops a tiny tail here. In an arbitrarily short time, develops a tail which goes right to infinity. Okay, Schrödinger equation is not causal. In a arbitrarily short time, it develops an exponentially small tail. This tail goes like e to the minus 1 over delta t squared. Okay, so this is a way of explaining that this quantum mechanic, in a sense, you feel the singularity from the very first moment. Okay. And this will be important in a moment. I won't go through this algebra. You can find the time dependence of the tail using complex classical solutions, but I won't go through that. The main point is that in this tail, you have this dependence, 1 over phi, something like cosine of phi cubed. That's how the wave function goes. And the point is that the expectation value of phi, see, normally when we do quantum field theory, we talk about the background defined through the expectation value of phi. This actually doesn't exist. There is no background in this thing. Because expectation value of phi would be integral d phi, 1 over phi squared at large phi, square the wave function, cosine squared, times phi. But integral d phi, 1 over phi squared times phi, is log divergent at large phi. So this does not exist.
this cosine does not really lead this integral?
No, it's cos squared, so it averages to a half, positive.
Yeah.
So that doesn't help. So phi doesn't exist. Nevertheless, the problem, even though it's infinity, it's a small problem. Okay. The problem is that there's a tiny amount of the wave function out there. For all times, so basically you have this Gaussian wave packet, most of the probability is in the Gaussian. There's this tiny amount in the tail, exponentially small amount. The Gaussian sails off to infinity. It's only when the Gaussian wave packet hits the singularity that most of the probability is there. Okay? So it's still a perfectly reasonable approximation to pretend this exists. The error you're making is exponentially small until the wave packet actually hits the singularity. So for an initially localized wave packet, there's a large flight tail, it's unimportant except near the singularity. And basically, this is all controlled by lambda. This, we only have one friend in this calculation, which is lambda, which is 1 over the log, which is a small number. And it turns out that if I make my initial wave packet, and I choose the spread so that it remains as small as possible throughout the bounce, okay? Then the time involved in actually hitting the singularity is smaller than the total time taken by a factor of lambda, actually square root of lambda. And that means that the sort of the part of the dynamics that's impossible to describe using quantum field theory is very localized in time. And for the modes, we're interested in, they'll all be frozen and their dynamics will be trivial during that, the sort of the part we can't describe using QFT. So what happens at the singularity? So I'm going to, I'm actually not going to show you the full thing. We have solved the full thing. You can just solve it on a computer. But I'm just going to show you the exact solution for a free particle incoming Gaussian wave packet hitting a brick wall. So here's chi. That's our 1 over phi. For some reason, I've chosen it negative. Why? And here's our Gaussian wave packet. So this is a quantum test for you, since you've survived so long in my talk. what happens next? Right-moving Gaussian wave packet hits a brick wall. What happens? Slava. Test. a right-moving Gaussian wave packet hits a brick wall. What happens next?
Reflects.
How? Describe the shape of the wave function.
Very fast away.
Yeah. What is the shape of the wave function as it hits the brick wall? Nobody has ever got this question right. Somebody must know the answer. What happens to the shape of the wave function as it hits the brick wall?
It will be deformed, of course. Yeah.
In what way?
In order to
get its spherical spun.
Gets what?
It's spherical.
Excellent. Somebody knows their quantum mechanics. Okay. He should, of course. He should, of course. Okay, there. Okay. So essentially the reason is true. The wave function has an e to the I px out the front. And normally you would square that and it would disappear. But if it's hitting a brick wall, the e to the I px has to turn into a sine of px so that the wave function is zero at the wall. And so these oscillations are visible in the psi square. Okay, so it oscillates like mad.
It's positive, or it is a square.
It's psi square. That's psi square. So if you integrate under that curve, you'll get 1. Okay? And then it comes back, and that's it. Okay, so that's how a Gaussian bounce
works. So why it's
important? Why? That's the Big Bang singularity, Slav. That's very important.
It's a wave packet which is hitting the wall.
Yes.
It's not a
singularity. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. In this theory, it is. Okay. So as I said, the background fluctuation split in phi fails totally near the singularity. But chi, you see, chi is 1 over phi. And so if I consider the expectation value of 1 over phi, that's perfectly convergent at large chi. So expectation value of chi is not divergent at large phi. Actually, it diverges at small phi. But as long as the wave packet doesn't have much support at small phi, it's a good approximation to go to chi. So you work out the fluctuations in chi, and basically what happens is the fact that when I bounce off a brick wall, the expectation value of chi never hits zero. Okay, that's obvious because the wave function is zero at chi equals zero. So expectation value of chi is always positive, or negative in my picture. And so basically, when you work out the fluctuations, this imposes a UV cutoff. The fluctuations in chi are cut off because the term which enters is always finite.
But you know, this consideration that people only you from the ground. From the ground becomes completely uncertain. So
there's a fixed background. It's a three sphere cross time.
Still, but you know, the picture when you go to reflection,
yeah.
Then there is a square, for instance, of this classical expectation wave.
Right.
Which could be larger than this kind of things. Is amplitude, as you understand, near the singularity. So how could you apply actually this equation when you just write linearized value for the ground?
You're right. This is only qualitative, this picture. Okay? This is not precise. This is not precise. I agree this is only a heuristic argument, okay? Which is that near the singularity there will be finite particle production in chi. So all this really is an excuse to change variables from phi to chi. Okay? And then when you do that and you say this guy is always finite, you don't you won't generate. But you're right, this is only a heuristic.
But is the statement of that extension or generalization chi is a well-defined operator?
Yes. Yes. It's not very well, that's going a bit strong. It is well defined in terms of being convergent at large phi. And of course chi is 1/5, so it's badly defined but small phi.
No, I think as an operator there's no there's no very with the other input space and you
yes.
Have done something to your input space.
So yes.
Is this thing now that this
chi is not no chi is not well defined.
You know, bounded operator.
No.
Chi is
neither of them are well defined. One is a good approximation at small phi, and the other one is a good approximation at large phi. And neither of them have well defined expectation value everywhere. Okay, so that's the state. One could try to construct operators which do have well-defined, but we haven't done. Maybe that is what one should do. Okay, so I think I've exhausted your patience enough. Basically, this is what I explained in words. You have a wave function which has the least possible spread in bouncing off the singularity. Away from the singularity, you can use ordinary quantum field theory to describe it, this split. You solve for the classical background. It turns out this is 1/T. The log introduces corrections. So this little L is the log. That's a large number. So you can solve for the background. You can solve for the perturbations. Just an expansion in the log. You can evolve incoming modes till they become frozen, and then match them across the singularity using the self-adjoint extension, which basically means match the time delay and the energy perturbation. And now you can compute particle creation. At leading order in the log, there's actually no mode mixing. The Bogoliubov coefficient is zero across the singularity, so vacuuming is the vacuum out. But at next order in the log, it turns out the two modes mix, and you can compute the Bogoliubov coefficient. It's suppressed by the log. So you can calculate the particle production in going through the bounce, just the usual formula. And here, it's very important, this was cut off when the highest K modes sort of ceased to see the classic singular classical background. Instead, they see this chi sort of effectively chi background, and that cuts off the particle production. The total particle production is a very small perturbation on the total potential energy. This lambda comes in to help you. The potential energy at this cutoff is much bigger than the density of particles you created. The lambda helps you. So you can estimate how many bounces do I go through. Each bounce makes some particles. You can ask, and because I've got energy in particles, I will not go back up to the same point on the potential. Next time I come up, I'll go lower and lower and lower and lower. The number of bounces turns out to be 1/λ³. So if lambda is small, you get lots of bounces. As I said, basically because of scale invariance in the boundary theory, you're guaranteed that the stress energy correlators are scale invariant on the boundary. And so here they are. Expectation value in operator is whatever it is, the state you're working, minus the vacuum expectation value in the out state. These are scale invariant. And so if I do something naive and just compute delta rho over p plus rho, like a cosmological perturbation, this is suppressed by logs and times of scale invariant function. These correlators will determine the bulk correlators. And I believe, though we haven't shown this, that because it's scale invariant on the boundary, it will be scale invariant in the bulk. That's just a long calculation, which we're halfway through. But if that does work, then we have a very nice explanation for these scale invariant perturbations. Their amplitude is lambda cubed, okay, which is naturally small. Lambda is 1 over a log of a large number. The tilt is red because of the running of the coupling. So this log gets bigger in the UV. Okay, so that suppresses UV modes. That's why the tilt is red. They're Gaussian. The non-Gaussianity is proportional to lambda. They are scalar, and they're adiabatic. So if this model works, it gives a finite density of radiation, actually explains where the density came from at the bang. It was caused by a bang. The simple perturbations come out without any tuning. As I said, we're translating these into the bulk. We want to consider a 4D model. The 3D CFT on the boundary is a Chern-Simons theory, which is harder to work with, but still possible, should be possible. And then we want to glue, we have to glue this negative energy phase onto a positive energy phase to get a full cyclic model. So just to summarize, cyclic model is an attempt at a more complete cosmology than inflation, incorporating dark energy and dealing with the cosmic singularity. It's possible to generate realistic curvature perturbations before the bang, even within a 4D effective theory, as I showed in the first part of the talk. And if the second part works, we won't even need that. Okay, if the second part of the talk works out, these are actually going to be automatic. But the main difference is that inflation makes scale invariant tensors. In this model, you don't get it. You don't get significant gravitational waves. Okay, thanks.